On the Ground is produced by the Global NGO Executive Committee, a storied nonprofit that has for 60 years partnered with the United Nations to guarantee a voice at the decision-making table for civil society leaders. GNEC offers services to more than 1,600 UN-vetted global NGOs, which are on the front lines of tackling the most pressing issues of our time. I'm Adrienne Berg, a member of the NGO Committee on Aging New York and the host of On the Ground. And hello, this is Adrienne Berg, and I am delighted to be with you again today because we're going to be speaking about two very important things across several lines with several NGOs. And that is how to create collaboration and how to promote the interaction between civil society, folks, individuals, and the United Nations, so that it really becomes in the minds of those who are interested the significant resource that it really can be. And we're going to kick this off with Dr. Bobbi Nasser. She's represented the International Federation of Settlements and Neighborhood Centers, called the IFS, you'll hear more about that later, at the United Nations since 1991. And she served as the executive committee of the NGO Committee on Human Rights since 1997 and currently serves as its co-chair. Now, Dr. Nasser is a mental health clinician, has been so since 1969, so this is not her first rodeo in dealing with very significant issues today. She's worked with refugee communities for the past 36 years, including providing counseling to survivors of torture, human rights training, and leadership development. And she is currently on the board of South Asian Council for Social Services and a senior advisor for the International Center for Advocates Against Discrimination. And I first had the pleasure of meeting her and seeing how she operates, and I'm using that word really wisely, with regard to creating coalitions at an event this April at the United Nations, where she chaired a committee meeting and a wonderful presentation regarding the Office of the High Commissioner of Human Rights and the NGO Committee on Human Rights. And what she was there to accomplish, and I think did so, was to really understand and help the audience, the attendees, understand how they can communicate and work with the United Nations and use it as a rich resource, something very important to all who are listening. So thank you, Bobbi, for being with us today.
My pleasure. My pleasure. And I think your introduction was excellent. So thank you very much.
Thanks. Well, I'll tell you, I could have said a lot more because, as I said, you are an extremely experienced advocate. And you not only talk the talk, but you also walk the walk and deal directly with direct services, as well as with the advocacy and policymaking. So let's talk about that first. Did you simply wake up in the morning and say, you know what we really need? We need a big event at the United Nations where we can really talk to the High Commissioner's Office of Human Rights. Or how did you go about making that happen?
Okay, so I'm very happy that you're asking the question, happy to answer it. My story is I'm a retired social work professor. And when I was still active as a professor, I found out that there was this possibility of being more involved at the UN. And because I'm in New York City, it makes it much physically easier to get there. So I started exploring the whole world of non-governmental organizations and how to interact at the UN. And I found out that it can be done. And so this leads me to what happened when you came to this meeting that happened on April 3rd. Okay, so this, as you explained, was an exchange, a dialogue between the Assistant Secretary General for Human Rights and different members of civil society. And the way this came to pass is that starting back in 2011, through the NGO Committee on Human Rights, I had this ongoing invitation and involvement with the office to make sure that we could, meaning NGOs in general, could have a direct conversation dialogue with both the ASG, sometimes it was the High Commissioner, him or herself, and also members of the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights. And this has been a very productive exchange on both sides. They do want to be with us. In other words, the people that work within the Secretariat and specifically within the Office of the High Commissioner are very happy to have these exchanges, and they understand very well that the way the different mechanisms have come to pass, that's kind of a technical term, but there are a lot of different aspects of the ways that we as NGOs can interact with within the, I don't know exactly how to explain it, but there are these human rights treaties, there are quite a few ways that we can directly interact. In other words, if you or I are exposed to or have intimate knowledge of a human rights violation, it could be anything from something that we all know about, unfortunately, something like torture, or it could be all the way to economic problems with housing or water, or, you know, the kinds of things we think more as environmental. There are parts of the human rights system that we can go ahead and directly go to them with our issues, complaints, and then that's the most important part of developing coalitions, because they like it much better, as any part of the UN likes it, if we come together. They don't, you know, it's not as good if it's one NGO has one thing to say, another NGO has another slightly different thing to say.
Sure, you need a consistent and clear message because it becomes more powerful. And to tell you that this really website, the NGO website for GNIC, and also this podcast is really all about that.
That's
about how to create coalitions, how to break silos so that your voice is stronger. Now,
Yes. Let's
get specific. Let's go over to your NGO, the International Federation of Settlements and Neighborhood Centers, IFS. It is an NGO, and
Yes. It
does identify issues, and it does integrate with the systems, or you call the mechanics, the mechanisms that have to do with the United Nations, particularly with regard to human rights. So to make it vivid, give us an example of something that particular NGO might already have done, or what you're thinking of doing, or a different NGO that really worked with regard to integrating and getting the message across to the High Commissioner.
Okay, so I'm going to talk about this more as an ongoing process and also an ongoing challenge.
Sure.
So the organization I represent is basically throughout, I guess it's something like 40 plus countries at this point. We have, these are community-based organizations. So I'm much more familiar with them here in the New York City area. I think they're more prevalent, but I'm sure they exist I know they do in parts of the West Coast. But this would be your all-purpose community organization that's very involved in meeting the needs of people that live in the community. So, for instance, I know you're involved with a lot of the activity that has to do with human rights for older persons.
Correct.
So a lot of our agencies directly serve older persons. So then what we've done is we've tried our best to make sure that within the NGO world, that the issues that we discover on the ground in a very intimate way are brought into the conversation. And that's, I think, very important. We frequently do our best to bring in people that actually are experiencing whatever condition we're talking about. I think that's always a more powerful way to communicate. So we do quite a bit of that. And I'd say in terms of our success, it's been more when we're part of a coalition. So in this case, I'm referencing working with people that are older. But we've also done this with people that are migrants and having problems in terms of that kind of discrimination. We've also done it with people that are dealing with criminal justice system and making sure that they have more of a voice in coalition. So it cuts across quite a bit.
So let's talk about a toolkit. I'm going to call it a toolkit. It might be. Yeah.
Good language.
it's a great way of, and it can be real, an actual toolkit where, you know, you get hashtags and you get infographics and you get different things you can post, or letters or petitions. But the toolkit could also be speaking for advocacy. So I'm going to put you on the spot. We're speaking with Bobby Nasser here. She is really a veteran of advocacy, representing the International Federation of Settlements, the IFS, at the United Nations since 1991, on the NGO Committee on Human Rights since 1997, and currently its co-chair. So I think it's fair. I think it's fair play to really give you a real example so okay. that you can mentor the people listening here okay. who do not have all those years of experience.
Sure.
So right now, and you mentioned the field of aging, so I'm just going to use that as an example. We have a terrible human rights issue, we believe, and that is certain older women, particularly older women, are having their human rights taken away as a land grab.
Yes.
The real reasons for calling them demented or having no capacity or even witches is to incarcerate them or get them away from their property, and there's a land grab. So right. let us say that there's an NGO that's really concentrated just on this one issue of aging.
Mm-hmm.
What would they do? What would they do to get the problem heard?
Okay, well, one thing I think they should do and could do is deal with several treaty bodies. So I'm going to name one in particular because you mentioned women. And that's the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, CEDAW. And there's an ongoing openness on the part of the treaty body to have these kind of reports submitted. And I would highly recommend it. It's there's basically a way of finding out about all of this through the website for the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights. And you can, you know, as with any website, you can get to the specifics of how do you enter the problem. But definitely, in some parts of the world, this is the most horrendous kind of thing in terms of depriving people of not just their land, but any access to any resources, you know, literally stealing from them. So
Correct.
Yeah, so I would start there. There's several other special mechanisms, but I would start with CEDAW. And then I would also just make sure that the world of women's human rights and that whole world, which is a pretty good network, not a bad network, is fully informed. And I've seen this presented frequently during the Commission on the Status of Women, too. It's another place that this can. I think I'd go the women's route. Women are pretty good activists when they come together. And I went to Beijing. I've been to some of the conferences related to women, and that would be my those two things would be my top two recommendations.
And a follow up to that, really simple question: in terms of what you have considered to be the most powerful advocacy, and I'm specifically talking about human rights, and I'm specifically talking to your wheelhouse. Has it been creating an event as you did at the United Nations? Has it been petitions? What is the physical product that you think an NGO should work on in getting across? If you were to pick one with their limited resources and their limited amount of time for their advocacy.
Okay, well, you've asked a very challenging question because I never like to have just one. I like to have as many as possible.
That's an answer. Okay. Maybe that's something we have to hear.
Okay, so I always, and this goes for domestic politics as well as international issues like the type we're talking about now. I think to keep ourselves from getting depressed, we have to have several ways of approaching a problem, because if we hit a wall in one way, then it's good to go to another. But I have seen specifically the coalitions that have developed on women's issues to be very effective. And so the one would be that I would work very closely with the NGO Committee on the Status of Women, focusing on, and if we're talking about this issue we were just talking about, I would focus on that one there, even more so than working on with the aging coalition.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So pick the right partners is what you're saying, and see how successful they've been. So
yes.
before I have a couple of more questions, but the one that I usually ask last, but in your case, I want to ask it before last. If you were right now talking to somebody very close to you who was a young person, and they said to you, you know, Bobby, I'm very interested in advocacy and I'm very interested in human rights, but I don't want to get disappointed. I don't want to feel that I'm accomplishing nothing. I really want to make things happen. what would you say to them? Because you did mention the word depressed, and I hear it over and over again for people in civil society that are really trying hard, what I call change the world with their words and with their actions. You can get a little bit of a burnout. What would you say to a young person so they could sustain the kind of energy that you have for all of these decades?
Okay, so the main thing is I would say don't go it alone. make sure you're with people that are you really feel you're in the same zone with, that you have a real sense of connection. I would also try to make sure that I am connected to people who've been in the game for a while so that they can explain how the system works. And also to have very small goals. I mean, that might sound funny, but I think it's good to have feasible goals, and they might be really small, which is fine, but it's far less discouraging. So it could be as much that your work in the UN language, it's a lot about making sure that you hold on to certain resolutions. I mean, that's what they're called. And that you get the success of getting your language in a resolution. And I think on the domestic side in the U.S., we do this all the time when we're working on local legislation or we're working on, it could be state or federal, but anyway. And then when we see we have some success, I think we have to really take a moment, several moments and just say, wow, you know.
Celebrate yourself.
Good on us. Good on us. Wow, we did it. And so I think I would focus more on that, the local coalition, the feasible goal. And I mean, the thing is, I'm going to change a little bit to local. The thing I've noticed is that if you dive in and you start a program and it's helping people, you can frequently get funding for it. So I see this with people that are working on housing right here in the New York City. If they're already developing a program that's helping people with their housing, then they're much more likely to get funding from local, state, federal sources, and also foundations, whatever. So I think the thing is to dive in. I know a lot of people are doing this with climate change initiatives right now, and that can leave you feeling better. You know, so I find that I get cheered up every time I have a sort of feasible goal and I'm doing it with other people. And frankly, the meeting you came to cheered me up a lot.
Yes, it should. Well attended, high level speakers. Yes, absolutely. Yes. So I'm going to double down on what you said before we take a little break. When we speak with our next guest, and Bobby's not going anywhere, we're going to take a little bit of a break, come right back to her to find out what she's doing in the future and what her process is going to look like in the days, weeks, months, decades to come. I want to double down on what you said, because this is a learning opportunity. Every single time I've had the opportunity of meeting and interviewing somebody for this podcast on the ground about what's working, it has always been some sort of local program. And there was an old-fashioned statement, think globally, act locally. Well, it seems to work. It seems to be this minutia by minutia gains that becomes a world trend. Right now, we're going to tell you about a little news you can use. So don't you go anywhere. Did you know that this is the International Year of the Family? Well, on May 15th at 1:15 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. in Conference Room 11 at the United Nations headquarters, there is going to be a session on the family and the world. It is given to you by the United Nations Department of Economic and Social Affairs. Now, if you happen to be there, please drop by. But if you would like to be kept up to date with all of these meetings, please become a member of the GNEC newsletter family. It's absolutely free. Just go to gnec.ngo and sign up for our reporter. Now I'm back, and I'm back with my guest. I could not let her go because we're speaking with Bobby Nasser. She has represented the International Federation on Settlements and Neighborhood Centers, IFS. at the United Nations since 1991, served as executive committee on the Executive Committee on the NGO Committee on Human Rights since 1997, and currently serves as its co-chair. She's a mental health clinician. She's worked the work as well as talked the talk because she's provided counseling to survivors of torture, human rights training, and leadership development has all been under her purview over time. So because you have so much on your list, Bobby, and you are pretty tireless. That's the reputation of Bobby Nasser, by the way. What's next? What can we hope to see? If I was going to interview you again next year, what would it be about?
Okay, this is my big goal. My big goal for this coming year is to make sure that I find a way to let as many people as possible understand how they can interact with the resources available to them within the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights. And there's a lot there. So I'm going to work hard at translating. And by translating, I don't mean literally the language. I mean putting it into simple, user-friendly language about the resources that exist and how to access them. So that's my big goal for this.
Well, it's a fantastic goal because navigating the UN system to begin with is difficult. Being heard within the system is difficult. Understanding the right protocols so that you do things the right way sometimes is very difficult for people in civil society because if they've been in other types of organizations, they have different protocols. And so I have to offer on behalf of GNX on the ground, how can we help you? How can we have this a big job and a really worthwhile job? And I'm not sure it's ever been tackled quite that way before. What support do you need?
Okay, I'm going to do this. So every September, October, the General Assembly convenes. And this is going to be a little technical, but in the General Assembly, there are committees. And the third committee is the one that deals with human rights. And there are many reports that are entered into the third committee that really are almost unnoticed. And it's very sad to me, it's very sad, because they're very good resources. People put a lot of work into developing these reports and they're easily translated into an advocacy tool. So you can help me. Yep. I'll share them with you and then you'll help me figure out the best way to get them out to as many people as possible. Okay.
Well, that is fantastic because you have to know that the purpose of GNEC is the support of NGOs.
Great.
That is what this is really all about. It is the Global Executive NGO Committee of the United Nations for those NGOs that are related and have gone through the process of being certified by the United Nations. They want to reach the UN. That's why they are part of GNEC to begin with. So to help them navigate the system, regardless of whether it's the human rights or any other type of commissions, is already a step in the right direction. So we thank you so much. And yes, the support is there from on the ground.
Wonderful. Wonderful. That's great.
And what I always say is if there's one thing that you would like a younger person who's going into the world of advocacy to take with them in their heart, what would it be?
It would be this. First off, the UN is great in the sense that it really does have amazing people working there and amazing resources. And it's actually far more friendly to all of us than most people realize. And it's much easier to advocate at the UN than it is if we go to the Hill and go to Congress.
Well, so very, very important words because inspiration is what's going to carry everything forward. Thank you so much, Bobby. We'll be speaking again.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
And now news you can use. What's cooking at the United Nations? Well, a cookbook in support of the United Nations. What will you find in this cookbook? The Kitchen Connection Alliance, in close cooperation with the Food and Agricultural Organization of the United Nations and the United Nations Department of Global Communications, have developed an international cookbook to support how we eat for ourselves and for the planet. Celebrity chefs, organic farmers, indigenous cooks, food activists, share their favorite entrees and side dishes that are healthy, delicious, and sustainable. The cookbook features an introduction by restaurateur, activist, and entrepreneur Kimball Musk, with 75 recipes from the chefs, farmers, including ones that you will love. It's news you can really use. And hello again, this is Adrienne Berg, and of course this is On the Ground, and we're speaking with our second guest on this show, and yet she has so much in common with Bobby Nasser, because coalitions, sharing, mentoring, building, you hear that same theme over and over again from NGOs that are successful, and you're going to hear it here again. Because you're going to be hearing from Dr. Kate Armstrong. She's the founder and president of CLAN, Caring and Living as Neighbors. It's an Australian-based non-governmental organization committed to equity for children living with chronic health conditions in resource-poor countries. And it is a success. It started in Southeast Asia. It has continued now into Africa, into Europe. And you're going to be hearing about a brand new initiative that I think is going to really light you up and that you're going to want to learn from for your organization, but also support for CLAN. So thank you so much, Dr. Armstrong, for being with us today.
Well, it's a real pleasure. Thank you for having me, Adrienne.
Well, Laura, let's start here from the beginning. I think people want to know what CLAN is, C-L-A-N, like a clan. And I did mention diseases of children. What diseases are you targeting? How have you started and how have you expanded?
Thank you so much. So CLAN, I guess my surname Armstrong, Scottish background there, and CLAN really has that concept of people coming together as one, but also caring and living as neighbours. So we're really focused on equity for children living with chronic health conditions in resource-poor settings. So in high-income countries of the world, we'd estimate maybe one in every four children is diagnosed with some sort of chronic health condition. That's a condition that lasts for more than, say, 3 to 6 months. And that can be anything. We all know a child with a chronic health condition. But whereas in high-income countries, we have access to the medicines, the health professionals, the information, the resources we need to keep our children alive and help them thrive with their condition. In resource-poor countries, it's a very different situation. And very often these conditions are associated with enormous preventable morbidity, mortality, disability. So we're really committed to a community development, rights-based approach to ensuring children living with chronic health conditions in resource-poor countries enjoy the same quality of life as children in neighbouring countries, high-income countries, and that together we work as one and leave no child behind.
Now, you know, I've seen your videos, and there'll be references to that on a website of On the Ground and so on. And what I see here are many, many local initiatives that are amounting to what is really almost a worldwide improvement in the situation. So would you say, as we spoke about at the beginning of our show, to think globally but act locally? How have you gotten into these local regions to make really local direct service programs successful?
Yeah, it's a great question. Thank you, Adrienne. I guess I come at this through a few different lenses. Yes, I'm a medical doctor. I trained in medicine and worked as a clinician here in Australia for many years. More recently, over the last 15, 20 years, my work has transitioned more into public health. I work as a public health physician here in Australia. But I'm also the mother of a young person living with a chronic health condition. And I think that has really, as much as my medical, clinical, public health training, it's that role as a mother of a young person living with a chronic health condition that has informed my work with CLAN most. when our child who has a condition that most people have never heard of, congenital adrenal hyperplasia, it's the most common adrenal condition of childhood, and children need to take tablets 3 times a day for their whole life, and with that they can live a very a fantastic life. I don't like to use the word normal, but very fulfilling. They can fulfill
what does that mean? We could go on forever on that word, right?
I know, what is normal? But they can achieve their full potential. It's similar, I guess, to diabetes, where you take insulin, or hypothyroidism and you take thyroxine tablets. With CAH, you take hydrocortisone and fludrocortisone tablets. So when our child was at school, playing sport, having a great life, we heard about the situation in Vietnam, and children there were dying. They were suffering enormous morbidity and disability, stigma, social isolation, poverty. And I was very lucky to travel to Hanoi and visit the National Hospital of Pediatrics, as it was at the time, Vietnam National Children's Hospital now, and speak with the families and consult with the families, and really ask them, why is life so hard with CAH here? And their answers, we published the results in 2006, their answers really informed the development of CLAN's strategic framework for action and our 5 pillars, which we still use unchanged, really, some 20 years later. And we've really translated those that framework, the pillars, to a broad range of chronic health conditions now, probably over 10 conditions, over 15 countries. And it's really the same thing. It's about empowering communities of people who are living with the same condition to really address the 5 pillars. Families want affordable access to medicine, education, research and advocacy, optimal medical management, strong support groups and financial freedom. When you work with communities and help them achieve those 5 things, they achieve amazing things. And to your question, why do we work with people for so long? Parents, children, people with living with chronic health conditions, they're chronic. You know, my son still has the same condition he had 24 years ago when he was born. And so I'm still just as invested in this condition and this community as I was 24 years ago. So there's a real sustainability thanks to, you know, when you involve people living with conditions, that lived experience.
Yes, and, you know, this show on the ground is meant for NGOs to extrapolate from the answers that our wonderful guests give so they can mm-hmm. apply it to almost any situation. And what yes. I'm hearing here is nothing about us without us, which is actually the new yes. mantra that we have in the field of aging. But you started by asking the constituency what yes. they needed. And when you yes. build from that, oh, boy.
Yes.
But when yeah. you impose your assumptions, even yes. no matter how good and big your heart is, it's yes. very easy to go in the wrong direction. So let's take a look at this pillar one. Pillar yeah. one, in your case, was get them the medicine, get them access. Now, I yes. know that you are working on that in a brand new way with a new Mates for Kids project. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, thank you. We would find when we met with communities, because as part of the framework, strong support groups, we'd hold club meetings, bring families together for encouragement and support, but also education. And unless the issue of access to essential medicines was addressed, families could not concentrate on anything else at club meetings. You'd want to talk about how you manage the condition or this new book or this or that, and they'd always just put their hand up and say, but how can I get the medicine? How can we afford the medicine? We need the medicine. And when you need to have a medicine to keep your child alive, it keeps you fairly focused. And it's not just accessing medicine once. Conditions like type 1 diabetes, CAH, you need access to this medicine for your child's entire life to keep them alive. It's an extraordinarily difficult situation to be in if your country isn't set up with the systems and structures to make medicines affordably available over the longer term. So Over many years in the Asia Pacific region, we worked with colleagues in Vietnam, Indonesia, the Philippines, Pakistan, and each country had its own solutions to the issues around access to medicines. For some countries, it meant importing the drugs at high-quality drugs at affordable prices. That was the approach that Vietnam took, for instance. In Indonesia, they had a mixed approach where they started local manufacture of hydrocortisone but importing the fludrocortisone. Pakistan was truly remarkable and started local manufacture at a very cheap price of both drugs. And in fact, was so generous and agreed with to allow us to purchase the drugs at cost price. And we can buy enough hydrocortisone and fludrocortisone to keep one child with CAH alive for 1 year for $30. Thanks to the work in Pakistan. So that means now we can work with countries such as Zimbabwe, where we can commit to a 3-year supply of CAH medicines for every child living with CAH in Zimbabwe, purchase them from Zimbabwe, send them to Zimbabwe, and then the local stakeholders, the Ministry for Health, the hospital system, the medical doctors, the CAH community, local NGOs, they can then distribute the medicines to that community and support the community through that community development approach. And so we just found that whilst over 20 years we were really thrilled to have made changes in a number of countries, when we first learned about the situation, for example, in Zimbabwe in 2021, and just having been working on this for some 20 years and just the frustration of knowing there are just still so many other countries and children out there with need, we decided to establish a global movement called Mates for Kids, where we're looking to really fast track all of the lessons that we've learned, the systems, the processes, the tools, the resources, I guess using the knowledge to action framework and clan strategic framework, to really go, okay, let's start to scale this up. We have a unique opportunity. The sustainable development goals, the UN SDGs, are being delivered by 2030. Member states are all very focused on that. SDGs 3.2.1, 3.2.2 focus on a child and newborn mortality, reducing that. That's very relevant to this. And 3.4 focuses on reducing mortality associated with non-communicable diseases, chronic conditions. So whilst the world is really focusing on reducing child mortality and reducing mortality associated with NCDs, it's a great time to be really going, okay, well, in the case of CAH, that means really focusing on affordable access to medicines, but also strengthening communities and scaling newborn screening as well is another part of that. So we're now mapping a pathway out to 2030. We're deciding which countries. We're working across all 6 WHO regions within a community of practice, engaging pediatric endocrinologists and CAH communities and other stakeholders from around the world. We just had a meeting in Buenos Aires at the International Meeting of Pediatric Endocrinology, for example, bringing everyone together to really talk about, okay, we mean business, let's do this, let's go.
Now, what is persuasive? Let me explain what I mean by that. Right now we're talking about Pillar 1, which was the main thing you heard from the constituents. We need the medicine. How do we get the medicine? Then you went to the countries that you were targeting. And those were countries where getting the medicine itself was important. Then giving access to the citizens or residents was the next important thing. And then being able to afford it, whether it was from the pocket of the citizens or through the NGO or some other kind of financial support. But the beginning of it was going to the countries. Now, what was persuasive when you went there? And who did you know to speak to say, you know, Pakistan, you could become a leader here. You could actually manufacture this here. You could actually do so at a price point where we become your customer. Now, that's a very transactional, interesting thing to do. And I would wager that there are a lot of NGOs in all kinds of fields that would like to be able to have that kind of impact and action program. within countries. How was that done? How specific can you get with us just on that one point? What is persuasive there?
It's all about local champions. And so,
go ahead.
It's about people who care. And so you have a community of children with a chronic health condition, and if they don't have access to this medicine, they will either die or become very disabled and have a terrible quality of life. Alternatively, if you get them the medicines, they'll become really happy, healthy, fully contributing members of society. So even at that level, and for a low cost, for $30 US dollars a year, you can transform the life of a child with CAH. So the medicines are cheap. They're on the WHO's essential medicines list. We included them there in 2008. It's very achievable. So you've got something that's achievable. You've got something that's happening in high-income countries. Children, there's no mortality virtually associated with CAH in high-income countries. So you've got this issue of equity. We really need to be striving for equity. As you empower the CAH community, once you we commit to a 3-year supply to sort of put a stop to the mortality and the suffering, to strengthen the community and give everybody locally time to secure the local access and supply chain systems. But when you partner that with really extraordinary health professionals, we have the privilege of working with pediatric endocrinologists. They're pediatric doctors who've specialized in endocrinology. And they are just so dedicated and committed and caring and hardworking, seeking to achieve equity for the children that they care for. And these are very, very influential, powerful people in their own countries. They're well placed to speak with the ministries of health and politicians or other key stakeholders within their country. And they're best placed rather than CLAN to have those conversations about access. So, for example, in the case of Zimbabwe, once we were able to supply a 3-year supply, commit to a 3-year supply to keep all the children alive, the doctors in Zimbabwe could shift their focus from scrambling around on a day-to-day basis trying to find the medicines to actually making time to have those conversations with the Ministry of Health, with the pharmacy department in the major children's hospital in the country, really sort out the supply system amongst all the colleagues across the whole country, distribute those medicines. And so then you get to a point where after 3 years you have a very strong community, locally, the CAH community, and none of those families after 3 years are going to want their children to die. You've got health professionals who've seen, you know, experienced better ways of doing it, where there's access to medicines. They can focus on, you know, the more complex clinical aspects of the management. You've got ministries of health who you know, are really keen to, it's a cost benefit, and from a cost benefit point of view, it's much cheaper to spend $30 a year keeping a child alive than having them sick and dying and the depression and all of the things that come from that. So I really think at that local level, it's about empowering local champions and giving them the tools and resources and the encouragement to say, you know what, Zimbabwe, we've been doing this in Vietnam for 20 years. We've been doing this in Indonesia, doing it in Pakistan, doing it in all of these other countries. You can do it. Here are the tools and the resources.
I'm hearing over and over again from you this a way of thinking, which is almost as if CLAN, which is the organization that you founded, is the crust of a pie. It is there to hold everybody else up. And sometimes we even step out of the way once you've given the tools. And I do love your phrase that you use in describing the organization's philosophy. We'll say philosophy or values, which is don't reinvent the wheel, share it, which is really what you're doing. Now, I want to go to something very specific again. I read your reports, and they have infographics. They have charts. They have lots of numbers and know-how. What has been persuasive? Obviously, you could tell the story of a young child, which you do in the videos, but you could also give analytics. Right now, as you are persuading and going from one country to another to get local champions, what do you find more persuasive today as a matter of advocacy speech? Do people look for the numbers? Do people look for the costs? Are they looking for the individual stories, as charities usually use when they're soliciting funds from individuals? What's working right now?
Yes, it's a very good question. And I do think it's a multi-pronged approach, and different stakeholders are looking for different things. Some people, it's the stories and the videos. Some people, it's the data. As we approach 2030 with the SDGs, we're getting more and more into this quantitative aspect. So, for example, SDG 3.4 speaks to reducing the preventable mortality associated with NCDs by 30%. So we're really getting into this quantitative aspect of what will it mean to reduce the preventable mortality associated with CIH by 30% by 2030? How many countries are there in the world? How many, if we just take low, middle, upper middle income countries, what's 30%, if we were to work in 30% of those countries, how many children do we have to do? How many children are there with CIH in each country? Really getting into that granular aspect. With pediatric endocrinologists, giving them the tools to really rapidly understand the pediatric endocrinology landscape in their country. So which drugs are registered, which educational resources are available, is there a patient register in your country? Just really sort of rapidly providing clear snapshots of the situation in their country. And often once you do that, then people can work out the priorities and the problems themselves. They go, wow, yeah, no, we knew we didn't have XYZ, but looking at it in this context, that's priority. For the CIH community, we have CIH communities in high-income countries who are looking at some of the videos and the stories and going, you know what? $30 to keep a child alive, let's go for it. So Sri Lanka, as you may know, is going through financial crisis at the moment, and the poorest families are really struggling. And the CIH community of Germany raised enough money to provide free medicines for the 30% of the CIH community of Sri Lanka that is living in the most vulnerable circumstances. So we have the tools to help the doctors and the stakeholders in Sri Lanka identify the 30 most vulnerable children. And then they're able to, the families in Germany pay for the money, we buy it from Pakistan, we send it to Sri Lanka, and now the families have free medicines. So I think different things appeal to different people. It's about having this really holistic, comprehensive approach, but at the end of the day, always bringing it back to the CIH community. It always has to be. We work with, in our strategic framework, with a whole range of stakeholders, but we focus everybody's collective attention on the community. So it's never about clan, it's never about any other stakeholder, it's always about the community.
And I have a quick question for you, then we're going to take a break and talk about the relationship with the United Nations and how you support them and they support you. But my quick question here, we have always talked about advocacy speech and said that at the end of the day, you have to ask the right people, but you also have to ask them something that they can do, something that's doable, not a pie in the sky major request that really burdens them, but something that makes it easy to say yes to. That seems to me that you have a perfect protocol on that, that you're asking people to do something that is actually doable. And therefore, they simply do it. It's not, as you say, not so terrible to $30 a child. Well, let's make that happen. Let's identify the top kids that need it. Not so difficult. Make that happen. Have you ever run across a situation where you found that what you were asking could be easily done, but you got pushback? In other words, how have you handled when it does not go as smoothly as it could?
Yeah, look, it's a good question. I think one of the things that's really helped us is with the strategic framework, letting everyone who comes along and wants to help, because people are really when they hear about CLAN's work and the opportunity to help children with chronic health conditions in resource-poor countries, you know, it's appealing and people do want to help. Sometimes it takes time helping people understand or find their way to where their place and where they're best placed to help. And I think that's the beauty of our action plans, which maps out the whole big picture of what we're trying to do. And people go, you know what, actually, I see all the things that you're doing, but that's one thing that I could do. I could translate that educational resource from, you know, English to French or to, you know, into Bahasa Indonesian or something. And yes, I can't do everything else, but I can contribute this. And in terms of when there are knockbacks, of course, you know, over 20 years, you know, there's definitely, you know, funding applications or this, that, or the other that don't go the way that you'd hope. But we try to just remember that things work out the way they're meant to work out. And also the communities themselves are so resilient and they never give up. So why should we give up? And, you know, when you're part of a community yourself, well, I am part of the international CH community as an individual, as a mother, well, I've got nowhere else to go. So, you know, hard knocks, yes, let's just keep going and, you know, think laterally. And we actually, you know, have a saying in CLAN that we read out at the very start of every meeting, and that's to say, let's, you know, if any opportunity comes up, let's think about this, let's consider it. Let's, you know, not say, oh, that's really hard, but just say, well, okay, well, let's think about that, because every opportunity belongs to the children. It's that's not ours.
Every opportunity belongs to the children. Now, On that inspirational note, we're going to take a little bit of a break. But don't you go anywhere, because we come back. We're going to talk about this essential question. What is the relationship between this outstanding NGO, very successful CLAN, and the United Nations going both ways, breaking those silos between the NGOs and the UN? Don't go anywhere. Attention members of GNIC. If you are a GNIC-affiliated NGO and you're interested in high-quality online education programs at absolutely no cost to you with flexible schedules, we've got it for you. Through GNIC and Rutgers Preparatory School, we offer the Innovation Academy, a variety of programs that address both global and local challenges. Take advantage of this amazing opportunity to expand your knowledge, be connected, and be inspired by NGO leaders and educators. Just visit gnec.ngo and get all of the details for your free registration. Well, hello again, and this is Adrienne Berg with On the Ground, and my guest who you've been listening to and learning from, Dr. Kate Armstrong. She's the founder and president of CLAN, Caring and Living as Neighbors, an Australian-based non-governmental organization committed to equity for children living with chronic health conditions in resource-poor countries. And while starting in Southeast Asia, she is now with her organization in Africa and in Europe and going strong elsewhere as well with brand new programs. But one of the things that is so important about CLAN is they do have a strong relationship with the United Nations in both directions. And if you've been listening to the show, you know that several times Dr. Kate Armstrong herself has mentioned the Sustainable Development Goals, and she's targeting some of them right now for the 2030 aspirations. So let me ask you, Doctor, what has been that relationship? How early in the NGO formation did it start? And how have you supported the UN and vice versa?
Yes, look, thank you. I would say that our relationship with the UN has been a vital part of the success of CLAN. And in terms of an NGO, if you're wanting to choose something really powerful and rich and wealthy, you don't focus on children living with chronic health conditions in resource-poor countries.
I see.
You know, that's about as unglamorous.
That's sexy, huh? That's sexy.
You know, if you wanted to pick a really hard slog, you would pick that, quite frankly. Yes. You know, the communities we work with are amongst the least powerful, least wealthy, least influential people in the world. So the UN is the perfect sort of partner for us. We founded in 2004, and we, I think our first connection, we became part of, it used to be the United Nations Department of Public Information for NGOs, the UNDPI NGOs, and we became formally associated with that in 2010. But even before that, I mentioned before we worked hard and with a range of partners to get hydrocortisone and fludrocortisone tablets on the World Health Organization's essential medicines list for children. We achieved that in 2008. So that was our real taste of realizing, you know what, there's real power here. So we became formally associated with DPI NGO. And then from there we became, we attained special consultative status with ECOSOC in 2018. And I think that that has been very powerful. Being in special consultative status with ECOSOC allows us to engage in a lot of different UN events. We've participated in high-level political forums, for example, UN Women's Commission on the Status of Women 67, 66, 65. That's been a great forum for raising issues. Mothers, UN Women, Mothers Care for Children, it's a real natural fit. But also I think that the timeline of the UN, so when we first started, we were talking about the MDGs, the Millennium Development Goals, and then we transitioned to the SDGs. But it's just so important to stay in touch with that UN agenda. I liken it to a train on tracks. The UN's just like a train on a track. It's going, you know, heading towards 2030, and there's all these little train stops and where they get off, and there are consultations and civil society can make statements and there are declarations. Really important to keep, you know, an active eye on that. And so we were very, we found that the UN high-level meeting on NCDs, non-communicable diseases, in 2011, then in 2015 and 2018, we actively participated in those UN high-level meetings and formed a movement called NCD Child, which is still now going, was with American Academy of Pediatrics, and now it's with Sick Kids Hospital in Canada. But that was a movement that really sort of leveraged that UN agenda. So I'd really encourage NGOs to look at the UN, look at the SDGs, find out where the synergies lie, and see how they can contribute. Because once you become part of something bigger than yourself and a movement that's bigger than yourself, and you're contributing to that in a meaningful way, it's exciting and meaningful, and really can bring a lot of momentum and power to issues that are affecting the least powerful people in the world.
And I will also add to that that in my short time with the United mm-hmm. Nations and my relationship, a little goes mm-hmm. a very long way with the United Nations. It's yes. an extremely complex system. It's difficult yes. to understand how to navigate it. That's the bad yep. news. The good news is if you yes. get yourself into an event, yes. a side event, yes. a meeting, very little, it takes very little for yes. it to ignite. Have yes. you seem to have found that as well?
I would say that is very, very much the case. And I think the work that we did with NCD Child is a great example of that. The UN high-level meeting on NCDs in 2011 was only the second time the UN member states had ever come together for a health-specific topic. The first was HIV/AIDS in 2001, and they came together to talk about, you know, chronic conditions, NCDs, in 2011. But when I first read the declaration in late 2010, there was no mention of children, no mention yeah. of a life course approach to NCDs. But by coming together with civil society and engaging with the process, we were able to change it so that the member states acknowledged the need for a life course approach to NCDs, acknowledged children are affected by chronic conditions. And that has massive flow-on effects to national policies, ultimately you know, the SDGs themselves and development goals that member states set. But we still have a bit more to go on that. That's another whole story. But yes, but I completely agree with you. It's I'd encourage every NGO to explore it.
Well, you know, as you say, there's a lot to go, but I have no doubt that you will make it happen. And so I thank you so much for sharing with us, because this is what On the Ground Show for GNEC is really all about: listening to what is working and taking it to heart, being inspired by it, running with it for your own NGO organizations. A preview of things to come. In the June episode of On the Ground, you'll hear from Dr. Cynthia Stewin, the chair of the NGO Committee on Aging New York and the main representative to the International Federation on Aging to the United Nations. She's going to be speaking about what happened in April at the open-ended Working Group on Aging and what you can expect from their 2024 event. This is Adrienne Berg saying goodbye for now from On the Ground. See you soon.